right now, I think the last person up was Philip, so it's now Tanya's turn.
And I would like to recommend Philip Roth's new book. I love him as well. And it's a short little novel called Everyman, and it's absolutely unique. It's about a man who's... I never read a book like this before. It's told from... it's told in medical history. It's told... It's one man's medical history. So the protagonist... In fact, the protagonist doesn't even really have a first name in the book. And it's all told through medical history. And in fact, the book starts at his funeral. Hmm. And he's sort of identified through... You know, he's the, like... the brother of this person, and the son of this person, and the ex-husband of these three women, and so you feel like you don't really get to know him, but what you begin to realize is that it's a book about the body, and I think Philip Roth has called it Everyman because we all experience this, and we all die, and. This is a section where he's recovering from quadruple, I think, bypass surgery. And he's got a nurse with him. At home, it was more than 3 weeks before the exhaustion began to diminish, and he felt ready even to consider returning to work. After dinner, he had to go back to bed for the evening simply from the effort of eating, sitting up in a chair. And in the morning, he had to remain seated on a plastic stool to wash himself in the shower. He began to do mild calisthenics with Maureen and tried each day to add another 10 yards to the afternoon walk he took with her. Maureen had a boyfriend who she talked about, a TV cameraman whom she expected to marry once he found a permanent job. And when she got off work at the end of the day, she liked to have a couple of drinks with the neighborhood regulars in a bar around the corner from where she lived in Yorkville. The weather was beautiful, and so when they walked outdoors, he got a good look at how she carried herself in her close-fitting polo skirts and short skirts and summer sandals. Men looked her all the time, and she was not averse to staring someone down with mock belligerence if she was being ostentatiously ogled. Her presence at his side made him feel stronger by the day, and he would come home from the walks delighted with everything, except, of course, with the jealous wife, who would slam doors and sometimes barge out of the apartment only moments after he and Maureen had swept in. He was not the first patient to fall in love with his nurse. He was not even the first patient to fall in love with Maureen. She'd had several affairs over the years, a few of them with men rather worse off than he was, who, like him, made a full recovery with the help of Maureen's vitality. Her gift was to make the ill hopeful, so hopeful that instead of closing their eyes to blot out the world, they opened them wide to behold her vibrant presence and were rejuvenated. Maureen came along to New Jersey when his father died. He was still not allowed to drive, so she volunteered and helped Howie make the arrangements with Kreitzer's Memorial Home in Union. His father had become religious in the last 10 years of his life, and, after having retired and having lost his wife, had taken to going to the synagogue at least once a day. Long before his final illness, he'd asked his rabbi to conduct his burial service entirely in Hebrew, as though Hebrew were the strongest answer that could be accorded death. To his father's younger son, the language meant nothing. Along with Howie, he'd stopped taking Judaism seriously at 13, the Sunday after the Saturday of his bar mitzvah, and had not set foot since then in any synagogue. He'd even left the space for religion blank on his hospital admission form, lest the word Jewish prompt a visit to his room by a rabbi, come to talk in the way rabbis talk. Religion was a lie that he had recognized early in life, and he found all religions offensive, considered their superstitious, falderal, meaningless, childish, couldn't stand the complete unadultedness, the baby talk, and the righteousness, and the sheep, the avid believers. No hocus-pocus about death and God or obsolete fantasies of heaven for him. There was only our bodies, born to live and die on terms decided by the bodies that had lived and died before us. If he could be said to have located a philosophical niche for himself, that was it. He'd come upon it early and intuitively, and however elemental, that was the whole of it. Should he ever write an autobiography, he'd call it The Life and Death of a Male Body. But after retiring, he tried becoming a painter, not a writer. And so he gave that title to a series of his abstractions. But none of what he did or didn't believe mattered on the day that his father was buried beside his mother in the rundown cemetery just off the Jersey Turnpike. So it's kind of this book about how scary death is when you don't have religion, and how when the body fails you, I mean, he still has sexual desires, but he's unable to. It becomes sort of like everybody's story, I think. Mm-hmm. And people talk about. I hear elderly people talk mostly about what their cholesterol is and what and you know what their last surgery was and what their hip replacement was like, et cetera, et cetera. That sort of like becomes the stuff of life, I think. Mm. And it's a really like universal experience that not all of us are there yet, but we will be. And so.
And I think, as I remember reading some stuff when this book came out, that Roth was almost compelled to do some interviews saying that he was fine. That he was okay.
That he was okay because they think it's autobiographical.
And it's that same thing every. And I know, I'm sure writers just have to deal with this all the time.
Right.
People who write fiction, readers think
this is
about you, right?
Right.
So
no,
people were thinking,
they
think, Philip, are you okay? Are you having heart problems or something? And he had to say, no.
Writing a novel.
I am who I am, but this is a novel. This is not about me, and I'm okay. So don't. So don't worry.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. If people want to call in, by the way, and recommend a book, I can give the number again here, the focus number, same number as always, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Otherwise, we'll continue to talk with our guest, Tanya Leitzagos from Pages for All Ages Bookstore, and Philip Graham. He's writer and professor of English at University of Illinois. And they're here every once in a while, and we do these shows. And then it'll be a while we won't see Philip because he's going to Portugal.
For a year.
He's going to be on sabbatical for a year. The whole family's going there. They've been learning Portuguese. They've been doing the whole thing. So they're going to spend the year in Lisbon, I guess.
In Lisbon.
And I'm sure it'll all be extremely cool.
And he'll do a lot of writing while he's there, right?
Yeah, I'm going to do a lot of writing.
He has a lot of stuff he's got to finish.
I've got two novels that are almost done. I have the sequel to Parallel Worlds, the African memoir that my wife Alma Gottlieb and I have written. We're doing a sequel to that. University of Chicago Press will be publishing it. I'm finishing off a anthology of stories that have dreams in them. I'm going to be doing video essays on literary events in Lisbon for the Ninth Letter website. And I'm going to be a correspondent for McSweeney's, writing a column called Dispatches from Lisbon periodically every few weeks.
So this is not a vacation.
No, well, sabbaticals really aren't. I mean, I think, you know, people out there think, oh, those professors, they never do anything. Well, you know, we work about 80 hours a week. And, you know, we teach classes a few hours a day, but those classes don't get prepared for in seconds. They get prepared for in days. And we also, when we're quote-unquote off, we're writing our books, doing our research, and that often is even more work. So, you know, but I mean, I don't consider it work. I mean, I'm never happier than when
I'm writing. It's the work you want, yeah.
I'm never happier than when I'm writing. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, very good.
Okay, this is a short story collection, the only short story collection by an author who normally writes only novels, Octavia Butler. The book is called Bloodchild. Octavia Butler was the first science fiction writer ever to win a MacArthur Genius Fellowship Award. She's also one of the very few African Americans who write science fiction. And she's a marvelous writer. And these stories are so good because they're about the social relations that develop between different species. Between alien species and humans, and how that would work, and you know, and she's very interesting in how that she sort of shows the development of the symbiosis of the worlds. And another thing I love about her writing is that she doesn't over-explain. She just drops you in the world, and she talks about the world as if you know what she's talking about, and so you have to get clues about how this world works. Makes you pay attention very carefully.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful because, again, what she shows, how she shows the symbiotic relationships between aliens and humans is so fascinating, so provocative. And this is actually from the title story, Bloodchild, and I'll just read the first two pages. My last night of childhood began with a visit home. Tagatoy's sister had given us two sterile eggs. Tagatoy gave one to my mother, brother, and sisters. She insisted that I eat the other one alone. It didn't matter. There was still enough to leave everyone feeling good. Almost everyone. My mother wouldn't take any. She sat watching everyone drifting and dreaming without her. Most of the time she watched me. I lay against Tigatoy's long velvet underside, sipping from my egg now and then, wondering why my mother denied herself such a harmless pleasure. Less of her hair would be gray if she indulged now and then. The eggs prolonged life, prolonged vigor. My father, who had never refused one in his life, had lived more than twice as long as he should have. And toward the end of his life, when he should have been slowing down, he had married my mother and fathered four children. But my mother seemed content to age before she had to. I saw her turn away as several of Tagatoy's limbs secured me closer. Tagatoy liked our body heat and took advantage of it whenever she could. When I was little and at home more, my mother used to try to tell me how to behave with Tagatoy, how to be respectful and always obedient, because Tagatoy was the Tlik government official in charge of the preserve, and thus the most important of her kind to deal directly with Terrans. It was an honor, my mother said, that such a person had chosen to come into the family. My mother was at her most formal and severe when she was lying. I had no idea why she was lying, or even what she was lying about. It was an honor to have Tagatoy in the family, but it was hardly a novelty. Tagatoy and my mother had been friends all my mother's life, and Tagatoy was not interested in being honored in the house she considered her second home. She simply came in, climbed onto one of her special couches, and called me over to keep her warm. It was impossible to be formal with her while lying against her and hearing her complain as usual that I was too skinny. "You're better," she said this time, probing me with six or seven of her limbs. "You're gaining weight finally. Thinness is dangerous." The probing changed subtly, became a series of caresses. "He's still too thin," my mother said sharply. Tagatoy lifted her head and perhaps a meter of her body off the couch, as though she were sitting up. She looked at my mother and my mother, her face lined and old-looking, turned away. "Lean, I would like you to have what's left of Gon's egg." "The eggs are for the children," my mother said. "They are for the family. Please take it." Unwillingly obedient, my mother took it from me and put it to her mouth. There were only a few drops left in the now shrunken elastic shell, but she squeezed them out, swallowed them, and after a few moments some of the lines of tension began to smooth from her face. "It's good," she whispered. "Sometimes I forget how good it is." "You should take more," Tagatoy said. "Why are you in such a hurry to be old?" My mother said nothing. Now, it seems like, oh, okay, well, you know, the kid's being fattened up and then the alien's going to eat him, you know? Well, no, it's much more interesting and complicated than that. But that's what's so wonderful about this writer is that, you know, she doesn't spin out simple tales. Mm-hmm. She doesn't spin out simple worlds. And she writes beautifully, simply, directly. This is a terrific collection of stories.
Yeah. She just passed away.
I think she's in the late 50s. And terribly, she fell down the stairs and died. You know, she had a lot more books inside her.
Yeah, she was not. I think she was only 58.
Yeah. It was really tragedy. Yeah. Really tragedy. A lot of people were very, very upset by this.
Yeah. I didn't realize that's how she died.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Octavia Butler, certainly for people who are interested in reading her, there are a number. She has a lot of stuff.
She has a lot of books.
She had a lot of books.
Lots of books.
So if she's new to you, you can certainly go and read what she has written.
Yeah, I would say that Blood Child is a good way to start because they are short stories, and if you like her style, like what she's doing, then you know you have a lot of pleasure ahead of you.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Well, Tanya, you want to take another turn? Oh, is she pointing at the phone? Yes, indeed. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. And this is Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Your caller would like to suggest two valuable books on food. Michael Pollan, who's written several fine volumes, has now out The Omnivore's Dilemma, a history of food in four meals. This consists of the agribusiness meal, the organic natural industry meal, the clean farm meal, and the gathered wild food meal, or the hunted wild food meal. Fascinating read.
Wow.
Also, Nancy Harris as genetically engineered food. This is a balanced discussion from Gail Thompson. Both of these are fascinating and important reads on a most interesting subject.
Yeah, we have a copy of Michael Pollan's book, this new book, and I think that we're going to try and see if he would be on the show with us. I'm hoping that sometime over the next few weeks or so, sometime this summer, that we would have him on the show to talk about that. So, and he has been on before, and I think he's an interesting guy to talk with.
He certainly will make an interesting guest.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the suggestions. We appreciate it. And others who are listening, if you have a book, something you've read recently or come across recently you would like to recommend, feel free to do that. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And again, the books that Philip and Tanya are recommending, if you do have internet access, they are on our website. So go to will.uiuc.edu and you will see them all there. Tanya, you want to take another turn?
Okay. Jodi Picoult is just one of my favorite summer reads. I've read a ton of books by her. And you know how sometimes you read things for sort of the beauty of the story or the beauty of the writing or you really like a writer. The thing about this writer is that she's just a master of plot.
Yeah.
She's just so good with plot. It's all very plot heavy. All her characters are really accessible. This is a fun summer read, even though the subject matter that she usually deals with is kind of difficult. And in this case, among other things, she deals with date rape. And she deals with a young woman who we're not really clear, the reader is not really clear whether she has in fact been raped. But she certainly seems to believe that she has been, and her parents are furious. And the reason the book is called The Tenth Circle, This is kind of a new thing for her. The mother of the daughter, first of all, is a Dante professor. And she teaches a whole class.
Yeah.
Right.
Tenth Circle of Hell.
Right, exactly. The Tenth Circle of Hell. And also, the Tenth Circle is the title of the girl's father's graphic novel, which is interspersed in the actual novel. So within the novel itself, there is a graphic novel also that you're following along with the girl's father, who is an illustrator and writer himself.
It's a real graphic novel.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I mean, the illustrations are pretty fantastic. And the cool thing, actually, maybe I'll wait till the end to say this part, but I'm going to read a little part of where she's teaching her students. The mother is teaching her students. Laura Stone knew exactly how to go to hell. She could map out its geography on napkins at departmental cocktail parties. She was able to recite all of the passageways and rivers and folds by heart. She was on a first-name basis with its sinners. As one of the top Dante scholars in the country, she taught a course in this very subject and had done so every year since being tenured at Monroe College. English 364 was also listed in the course handbook as Burn Baby Burn, or What the Devil is the Inferno? And it was one of the most popular courses on campus in the second trimester, even though Dante's epic poem, The Divine Comedy, wasn't funny at all. Like her husband Daniel's artwork, which was neither comic nor a book, The Inferno covered every genre of pop culture, romance, horror, mystery, crime, and like all of the best stories, it had at its center an ordinary, everyday hero who simply didn't know how he'd ever become one. She stared at the students packing the rows in the utterly silent lecture hall. "Don't move," she instructed, "not even a twitch." Beside her, on the podium, an egg timer ticked away one full minute. She hid a smile as she watched the undergrads, all of whom suddenly had gotten the urge to sneeze or scratch their heads or wiggle. Of the three parts of Dante's masterpiece, The Inferno was Laura's favorite to teach. Who better to think about the nature of actions and their consequences than teenagers? The story was simple. Over the course of 3 days, Good Friday to Easter Sunday, Dante trekked through the 9 levels of hell, each filled with sinners worse than the next, until finally he came through the other side. The poem was full of ranting and weeping and demons, of fighting lovers and traitors eating the brains of their victims. In other words, graphic enough to hold the interest of today's college students and to provide a distraction from her real life. The egg timer buzzed, and the entire class exhaled in unison. "Well," Laura asked, "how did that feel?" "Endless," a student called out. "Anyone want to guess how long I timed you for?" There was speculation. 2 minutes? 5? "Try 60 seconds," Laura said. "Now imagine being frozen from the waist down in a lake of ice for eternity. Imagine that the slightest movement would freeze the tears on your face and the water surrounding you. God, according to Dante, was all about motion and energy, so the ultimate punishment for Lucifer is not to be able to move at all. The very bottom of hell, there's no fire, no brimstone, just the utter inability to take action." She cast her gaze across the sea of faces. "Is Dante right? After all, this is the very bottom of the barrel of hell, and the devil's the worst of the lot. Is taking away your ability to do whatever you want, whenever you want, the very worst punishment you can imagine?" And that, in a nutshell, was why Laura loved Dante's Inferno. Sure, it could be seen as a study of religion or politics. Certainly, it was a narrative of redemption. But when you stripped it down, it was also the story of a guy in the throes of a midlife crisis, a guy who was reevaluating the choices he'd made along the way, not unlike Laura herself. And one of the interesting things here is that everybody in this book has their sin. And sort of you kind of go through the, if you've read The Inferno, you kind of go through the levels of hell with the characters. And at the end of the book, there is a, first of all, shocking ending. She always does the shocking endings. You think you've figured it out several times and you're never correct. But this is really neat. There's a note to the reader at the end of the book, and she's hidden a message. She's hidden the letters in the pages where the artwork is, where the graphic novel is. And it's actually a quote and the name of the author of the quote. And I haven't yet figured it out. I've found a lot of them. There's a website that I haven't gone to, and it may have the answer there, so I don't want to go to her website and find out before I figure it out myself. But it seems gimmicky, but it's so fun. It's such a great, like, summer read, like all of her stuff is. And I can't wait to find out what the... I thought I had it, but I don't have it.
So who did the graphic novel that's part of the book? Is it somebody who's really known for for doing that?
No, it's not. Illustrations by Dustin Weaver. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know a lot about graphic novels, so I don't know for sure if that's someone important, but I don't think so. Huh. But they're neat. I mean, it's a real, and it goes right along with, plus there's a lot in this book about Alaska. You learn a lot about Alaska because the father's originally from there and he's sort of fighting his demons from Alaska.
Love the idea of there being a graphic novel in that
in
novel.
The book. That, yeah,
really
it's kind
of
neat.
That's a great idea. It's one of those, God, I wish I thought of that.
We're going to take a second here to see if we can move some more books. Again, we are here. One of the things that we must do is remind people just how important their financial support of the station is. We don't do this so just for fun, you know. We have a serious purpose here, and that's to remind people that their financial contributions help pay the bills that keeps the station on the air. This is one of those times that we ask you to make a contribution. If you're not a supporter of the station, and there are people who have very generously, very loyally supported us for many years, to them we want to say thanks. But to those people who are listeners and are not supporters, we want to say, come on in. Join the friends of WILL. Be a supporter. 244-945 is the number. And Jack Brighton, web guy, producer emeritus, Focus 5A, what if they call in and make a contribution?
They will get a book. It's as simple as that. I don't know how much more simple it could be. Maybe none more simple.
None more simple. Yes. None more simple. That's the answer.
Right. 217-244-9455, and you'll get either a fiction or a nonfiction book. You choose. You can pick. And by the way, these are special books, folks. These are lucky books. They've been in the Focus 580 archive. Or collection, or whatever we call it these days. I don't know.
Or place anyway, under Harriet's desk where we just stack them.
right, exactly. But basically, what I want to say is that they will make you more special because you will have contributed something to the place that talks about books so much, that offers so much in the way of information and author interviews and all the great ideas and things that we do here on the show. And if you call, again, the number 217-244-9455, we will send you one of these books. It's a hardcover, brand new book from the Focus 580 collection. And when you read these books, you will feel special. It will be it won't be so distracting that you won't be able to concentrate, but there'll be something about the experience that'll be just a little bit more special than it would be otherwise.
And afterwards, people will look at you differently.
Your step will be lighter.
Your aura. It'll be there. And people will look at you and say, there's something different about you. Have you lost weight? No. You say, no, it's not that. I've been reading this book, you see. And that could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship right there.
I'm shocked that you say that.
Well, you know, it's true. Books can do that for you. It's actually, you know, possible. And coffee could be involved. And from there, there's
Stones,
just no telling. There's no telling where things could possibly go. All right. But the bottom line is, friends, that if you're not a supporter, and we know still all these years, I've been working on public radio here a long time. It's the only job I've ever had. And one thing that has never changed.
Well, there was the car wash.
Oh, yeah. And the pizza place. But that was no count.
Okay.
The one thing that has not changed all this time, even though the audience has continued to get bigger, that roughly speaking, one out of every 10 listeners is a supporter. And we'd like to change that. If we could get that to 2 out of every 10 or 3 out of every 10 or 5 out of every 10, that would be really something. Because then the kind of funding pressures that we're under, it wouldn't be as critical. We wouldn't be so nervous, mm-hmm. particularly nervous about cuts in government funding. So if you're not a supporter, if you're a listener and not a supporter, we hope that you'll call and make a contribution. Or you can go online and make a contribution that way. Whatever way you do it, 244-9455, willpledge.org. Whatever way you do it, we hope that you will do it, and they do it this week.
It doesn't have to be painful. I mean, I, as an employee of the university, I get money every month taken out of my paycheck. And I'm not going to say how much I give. It's more than the $5 example I'm going to give. But if you just give $5 a month, that comes to $60 a year, which mm-hmm. is not bad, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you don't even notice it, you know? You don't even notice it. And I should also say, if I can make anybody feel guilty out there, that while I'm in Portugal and not able to listen to WILL, I'm still going to be getting the money taken out of my paycheck.
What a guy.
I love the station so much. So just, you know, boy, you people out there, come on, you know?
If you're a listener to this station, it's something that you find a great deal of value. Surely you can give something back by making a pledge call.
Uh-huh. And they're out there saying, please don't call me Shirley, but I'll call and make a pledge anyway.
217.
If people haven't completely turned the show off,
come back.
Are you kidding me? This would be one of our best archives.
Then they must really like us if they haven't turned it off by now.
217-244-9455. Make that pledge.
All right. We have time for Philip and Tanya to recommend some more books, which they will do. And also, if people who are listening would like to do the same, you may. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And I think it's Philip's turn to go next.
This is a book, one of many books, by Pico Iyer, who is a travel writer. This is a book called Sun After Dark, Flights into the Foreign. He's written a number of other books, such as The Global Soul, Video Night in Kathmandu. And this is from his essay, I guess you would call it, Night Walking. It's a series of essays on travel around the world. And this is, in fact, about jet lag. Hmm. In my regular life, the one I call real, I go to sleep every night at 8:30. My body gets me up as soon as it is light, and by the time darkness falls, I'm starting to lose consciousness fast. At the corners of the night, therefore, everything associated with the sleeping world is as foreign to me as Antarctica. In my regular life, I know the time so well that I can tell the hour to the minute without looking at my watch. Under jet lag, however, all that is thrown into convulsions. Not just the steady routine, the sense of clear divisions, the ability to get on with the world, in sync with it. Now something deeper is dissolved. I get off a plane, 17 hours out of joint, and tell naked secrets to a person I know I don't trust. A friend starts talking about her days, her plans, her friends, the things she wants to do, and tears start welling in my eyes in a restaurant. I can't sleep at night, because I've been sleeping in the day, and so I go through my routine as I might in the daylight world. But I write the wrong name on the uncharacteristically emotional letter. I shower the stranger with endearments. I often think that I've traveled into a deeply foreign country under jet lag. Somewhere more mysterious in its way than India or Morocco, a place that no human had ever been until 40 or so years ago. And yet now a place where more and more of us spend more and more of our time, our lives. It's not quite a dream state, and yet it's certainly not wakefulness. And though it seems another continent we're visiting, there are no maps or guidebooks yet to this other world. There are not even any clocks. I live these days in Japan, and my mother, who is in her 70s, lives alone in California. Every time I want to look in on her, therefore, I get on a plane and take the 10-hour flight across the Pacific. But for a week, at least, after I arrive, I'm not myself. I look like myself, perhaps. I may sound something like myself, but I'm wearing my sweater inside out and coming out of an unremarkable movie, deeply moved. And I'm not the person I might be when I'm antic or giddy or have been up too late. I'm a kind of spectral being floating above myself. Every time I fly back to Japan, I become the meridian opposite of that imposter, a night wanderer who can't be trusted to read or write anything for at least another week. If I visit my mother 4 times a year, therefore, a reasonable thing to do in the ordinary human scheme of things, I spend 8 weeks a year, or almost a sixth of my life, in this nowhere state. Not quite on the ground, yet not entirely off it.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, I love that idea of no one had ever been in the place called jet lag 40 years ago. It's a new human experience.
Mm. So it's, but they're all travel essays?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All travel essays.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, Tanya, I'm going to take my turn.
I'm going to do another young adult novel. A sad one, a very, very sad one, a tragic one. It's a historical novel. It's called Day of Tears by Julius Lester. He's a really good writer, too, and has done a lot of young adult things. This is a book about a real day in history when the slave owner, Pierce Butler, was the biggest slave auction in American history. Single day in Georgia, 1859. And it's interesting that it's a young adult book, because in reading it, I mean, I had tears in reading it, and it's very graphic. It's very heavy. And I thought in some places, you know, this is too much. This is too real for a young adult reader. But then I realized that I think he wants it to be. Mm-hmm. I think he wants it to really be. So the way that he writes it is actually as a play. It's a novel in dialogue. Mm-hmm. Not really a play. He calls it a novel in dialogue, but it reads very much like a play. Mm-hmm. And there's a family tree in the beginning of it, so you can tell who everyone is. Mm-hmm. But this gentleman was sort of a popular slave owner. His slaves loved him, respected him, and trusted him. And he convinced them that he would never, ever sell them, and he would never abuse them. And he just lied. He just absolutely lied. What happened was he got into some gambling debt, had a lot of trouble, needed money, and decided to sell his entire plantation, all of his slaves, and except for, I think he kept like 14 slaves to maintain his house and his family. Something I never thought about in all of the movies and books that there are about this subject, I never thought about the children of the master. The children of the master, they're just children, and they're growing up around slave children. And children don't segregate. Children don't, they know, his children know that they're supposed to, but they can't help but be close. And especially since the wet nurse, you know, I mean, the slaves cared for the children, you know, for the master's children. And so they felt like siblings, a lot of them, to some of the slaves. And I'm going to read one little section. It's really chilling. Little Francis is one of the daughters of the plantation owner. And the reason the book's called A Day of Tears, by the way, is because apparently it rained constantly. It poured during that day. Rained and rained and rained. I'm glad Papa said Emma's coming to be with Sarah. That means I'll have Papa all to myself. They're on their way, actually, to the auction at this point. He says I'm like him and Sarah is like Mama. I miss Mama, but I don't miss hearing her and Papa arguing all the time. I'm glad she's not here today, because I know she and Papa would be arguing about him taking me to the auction. Papa said the plantation will be mine one day. He says his papa started teaching him all he needed to know when he was about my age, so it's time for me to start learning too. But I don't think there's going to be much for me to learn, because after today we won't have many slaves. But Papa said he will not gamble anymore, and that he's going to build the plantation back up. I'm glad Papa didn't take me to the auction yesterday. That's when Ovid was sold away. Ovid was teaching me how to ride a horse. Papa said no one I know is being sold today. At supper last night, Mr. Weems said you can't let your feelings get in the way of business. I suppose he's right. Mama would go down to the quarters and talk with the slaves like they were her friends. Papa would tell her not to, but she would anyway. Papa said she was spoiling the slaves, that she was making them lazy. Papa said that slaves were lazy enough without any help from her. Ovid wasn't lazy, or maybe he was and I was too young to see it. I hope Papa will teach me how to tell when a slave is being lazy and when he isn't. Mm-hmm. So what you see in this, like, 11-year-old kid is that, first of all, he has a friend. He's losing a friend. But you also see how the next generation is being taught. You know, you see it. I mean, it happens so early. He knows he's supposed to be able to tell when a slave is being... She knows she's supposed to be able to tell when a slave is being lazy. Mm-hmm. Okay, Emma is a slave girl. And she's talking about the stables where the slaves are kept right just prior to the auction. I look over at the stalls. There's Aunt Hagar. Whoever buys her better look out, because she can fight just as good as a man and maybe better. She ain't that big, but that don't matter none. Even Jenkins, the overseer, is scared of her. One time he told her to do something, and she say she'd do it tomorrow. And he say, nah, he wants it done right now. And she say, tomorrow. And turn and walk away. And old Jenkins didn't do a thing. He just stood there and stared after her. And he didn't give her no whooping either. There's Joe. He's a little older than me. Somebody told me that he was sweet on me. Maybe he is, but with him working in the field and me working in the house, I don't know for myself if he liked me and how much. Many nights I don't get back to the quarters from the big house until everyone's asleep. That's how it's been, especially since the mistress left. I spend many a night sleeping in the girls' room, because Miss Sarah be crying so hard about her mama leaving. Joe is going to be sold today, and I'll never know if he was sweet on me or if I would have been sweet on him. A white lady in a long blue dress walks over to the stall where he is. She looks at him. He doesn't look back at her. He's just staring straight ahead, his face as blank as the boards of this barn. I wonder what he's looking at. I wonder what he's seeing. A few of the slaves look like they want to kill somebody. Most of them, though, look like they're not here. If I was going to be sold away, I think that's what I would look like. I would be trying to get ready for whatever was going to happen to me. I would be angry later. And later on, they show you a list, and it's not like we don't know this in American history, and it's not like we're not taught about it, but when you see it on a page, like an inventory, it's pretty hard. Number 103, Wooster, age 45, field hand and fair mason. Number 104, Mary, age 40, cotton hand. Sold for $300 each. Number 105, Commodore Bob, aged, rice hand. Number 106, Kate, aged, cotton. Number 107, Linda, age 19, cotton, prime young woman. Number 108, Joe, 13, rice, prime boy. Sold for $600 each. Number 109, Bob, 30, rice. Number 110, Mary, 25, rice, prime woman. Sold for $1,100 each. Number 111, Anson, 49, ruptured one eye. Number 112, Violet, 55, rice hand, sold for $250 each. And when you see that on a page, like check, 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 it does something. And most of this book is like that. And part of me does feel like it's a little too graphic for young adult eyes, but the other part thinks... It was a graphic thing that happened.
Yeah, why sugarcoat it?
Absolutely. Yeah, so beautifully written, all in dialogue. Really affecting, affecting book.
Okay, Day of Tears, that's the book. And again, for people, if you're just joined us, we're talking with Tanya Liatsakos from Pages for All Ages Bookstore. Philip Graham, he's a professor of English at University of Illinois. Occasionally they're here. They recommend books. And if you have internet access, you go to our website, will.uiuc.edu. The titles and the authors of all the books that Philip and Tanya are talking about are there. Also, the books that the callers have called in to recommend, they are there too. So you can go there and get the information, then go down to the library or go down to the bookstore and look for the books. Maybe we can do at least one more.
Yes, okay.
From Philip.
Already. This is a wonderful novel.
Oh, you've talked about this.
Mm-hmm. It's by Salvador Plasencia, and it's called The People of Paper. And it's a book that reveals itself in strange and funny ways, and it's a very, very unusual book. There isn't more I can say here. Okay. This is about a woman who, in fact, has been... Well, it's about, let's say, Antonio. And his name was Antonio. And like all stories of creators who bring life from the dead, his story began with a struggling butcher who chased a gray cat, caught it, took off its studded collar, and slit its throat. The fur and organs were scraped from the cutting board into the trash bin, and the warm meat was placed in the refrigerated display case with a skewer and flag that read feline, 3.15 pounds. Antonio was only a boy, still wearing his grammar school uniform, when he saw his Figaro split open and naked. At the counter, without crying, he pulled 6 bills from his pocket and ordered 3 pounds of feline. Antonio received Figaro wrapped in the white butcher paper, and while there was sadness and the urge to change from his grammar school uniform to one of mourning, he resisted, instead walking to the stationery shop, buying the Sunday edition and a roll of hand-pressed construction paper. Locked in his room for 3 days, he folded and tore away at the paper. On the second day, and after 33 paper cuts, all minor except for one that cut deep into the meat of his hands, there were 13 perfect origami organs and ropes of wound capillaries and veins made from tissue paper. When he unwrapped Figaro from the butcher paper, there was still warmth in the cat's body despite the gutting and the hours of refrigeration. The paper heart went in first, followed by the main veins and then the smaller capillaries. Antonio connected liver and lungs, the stomach and newsprint digestive tract, patching the belly with college-ruled sheets, and before the last layer of crumpled paper could be flattened, Figaro was playing with his tail. It was through this experience with the marvels of paper and his pet cat that Antonio discovered his calling. After 5 years of medical school and lab experiments with series of radial pleats and reversed folds, Antonio became the first origami surgeon. Medical journals tried to discredit the merits of paper. They said the velocity of the circulating blood would punch holes through the compressed wood pulp, supporting their claims with hand-drawn charts of exploding hearts. But Antonio's hearts never leaked or burst. And as a tribute to his doubters, he shaped the cardiovascular walls using the index pages of the journals.
Crazy.
Now, this book does wonderful things on the page. There are chapters in which you have columns going down, 3 separate columns going down the page, and they're all different characters who are doing things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So as you read it, you get this wonderful sort of omniscient narrator overview of what's going on among all these characters. Mm-hmm. Lots of playful typographical things going on, but none of it just to do it. All of it for a good reason.
For a reason, yeah.
And what you have with all these characters is they are people who live in a town. They're flower pickers in a town in Southern California, and they're very upset about Saturn. The planet Saturn, according to them, is this invasive effect that is always getting into their thoughts and invading their privacy, and they're creating a war against Saturn, doing everything they can to push Saturn out of their lives. And you read it, you go, what the heck is going on with Saturn? You know, you don't get it. You know, it's like, what's happening? But the writing is so engaging that you keep going on. Well, it turns out, and I'm going to give away something here. This is before I go off to Portugal. I'm going to give something away. I'm going to do it.
I'm going to make a note about this day.
This is a first,
I'm going to give something away.
I don't want to hear anything from you anymore.
Saturn is, and you find that, a certain way into the book, Saturn is, in fact, the author of this book.
Ah!
He is the author who is trying to figure out his characters, and they don't want their privacy invaded. Now, as a writer of fiction and as a teacher of the writing of fiction, I'm always telling my students, we need more access to the interior lives of your characters. We need more access. We don't understand your characters well enough. You have to get into what their point of view is and so forth. Well, here's an author who's trying to do it, and his characters are resisting. And what he's doing is he's imagining a world which the characters are, leave us alone, will you? We have our own lives. Stop looking into our minds.
That's
you know?
Really
and
original.
And so they're fighting back at him. And so the rest of the book is the struggle between the author, who they call Saturn, trying to figure out ways in which he can gain access to their private thoughts, and they're trying everything they can to prevent that from happening. And near the end, you have this wonderful situation where Saturn, his point of view is on the left page, and there are five other characters' point of views on the fifth. But as they start to fight back, Saturn gets less and less page space. He gets squeezed to one of two columns and then part of one of two columns and then a smaller part of that column till there's almost nothing left of him as they're taking back. But of course then he starts getting bigger again. Well, I shouldn't say anything.
That's
but,
extremely
but it's,
original.
It's like no book I've ever read. And it sounds like, oh, why would I want to read a book about a guy who's trying to write a book and the character, blah, blah, blah. But the world that he has created is so fabulous and marvelous that you love all the characters who he's struggling to learn more about. And in fact, as the reader, you're learning more about them than he's able to learn himself. So it's a very complicated book on one level, and yet it reads like a dream. You're constantly amazed at the nerve and the audacity, the conceptually, of what Salvador Plasencia, the author, has done here. It's just a brilliant, wonderful, fabulous novel.
It's like the opposite of navel-gazing or something. It's like he wants to take himself out of the equation and let the story...
Let the characters have their own lives instead of him invading them. And he is, at the same time, trying to write a novel that's sort of autobiographical and magic realist at the same time that you realize is so much reflected in the characters that he's writing about. So there's another layer gets added to it. It just goes on like that. And you're always surprised, you're always delighted, and you love the people in this book.
Where's he from?
I think he's a Mexican-American writer. He's living in California now. I think he has his degree in the Syracuse University MFA program. It's the first novel.
I mean, nobody's ever done that.
No, it's just an amazing book. Yeah. It's an amazing book. Salvador Plasencia.
Well, that's one of the books that you can get the information on the website. It's wyll.uiuc.edu. The books that all this morning here, Philip and Tanya have recommended. So that should give you something to read for a while.
Yeah.
That should hold you for a while. Yeah.